The hour of 9 a.m. having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee. And members, today we have two groups that are going to testify before we move to the main topic before the committee. These two groups have in effect testified in variations before, but specifically you have Keith Carlson here from the Minnesota Inter-County Association. And while he does not represent all of the counties in Minnesota, he does represent counties in Greater Minnesota and the metropolitan area. In Greater Minnesota, primarily those that have a regional center. And then we have the Minnesota Newspaper Association. So if Mr. Carlson would like to come down, and I believe there should be a handout in your packet. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. As the Chair noted, we consist of 13 of the larger counties, 8 in Greater Minnesota, and 5 here in the Twin City metropolitan area. Perhaps apt that I'm here today for your discussions on conference committee process, because as many of the committee members know, our organization, on behalf of all 87 counties, did lobby for a provision that was added to the tax bill in the last hours of the session to reduce our spending obligations in response to another last-minute provision that imposed very restrictive levy limits on counties. I'll be happy to discuss those in further detail if the committee would like, but for now I'm going to focus on the bigger picture. As the chair noted, I do have a handout that's titled The Legislative Process and Its Effects on Counties. I think the first thing that the committee needs to understand is that counties are relatively unique among local governments in that our financial situation is affected by a multiplicity of committees rather than the norm for the cities or the school districts of one committee basically controlling their fate. In our instance, the Agricultural, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs Finance Division determines the funding for our Veterans Services Office and our pesticide disposal program. The K-12 Finance Division determines the funding and has, or if not more importantly, the funding level that we're required to maintain for libraries. The Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division dictates what state funding we receive for the solid waste management programs that we are mandated to provide by state law, as well as various water management programs. Then the Healthcare and Human Services Finance Divisions determine funding, and again, as importantly, minimum spending obligations we have to meet for various programs that I'll get into a little further detail later. Then the Housing Policy and Finance and Public Health Finance Division determines the funding we receive in the public health area. And finally, the Tax Committee determines the funding that we receive for our version of local government aid, called County Program Aid, as well as the parameters of the property tax system, including for this coming next 3 years, levy limits. It's probably no surprise that one committee's actions on counties sometimes undermines that of another committee's in this process. For example, this year, the health care reform bill created a new state health improvement program that's targeted on the chronic health problems created by smoking and obesity. And a key element of that is a competitive grant program called the State Health Improvement Program, where counties are expected to implement programs to reduce those behaviors and ultimately result in long-term savings in healthcare expenditures for the state as well as the private sector. Unfortunately, the tax bill completely ignored the fact that counties are required to come up with a 10% match there. And consequently, unless we're successful with the Department of Revenue to get them to give us a little leeway, we may not have the levy authority to come up with those funds.
Mr. Carlson, you would not have the levy authority because of the levy provision that was put into the tax bill?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Mr. Carlson, do you have any comments on the committee structure? We have had some discussion of the committee structure in the four previous hearings, and you've noted a few of the committees here. Has this session's committee structure been uniquely different than previous sessions? Do you have any observations for us?
Mr. Chairman, members, I think obviously the committee's aware that there was sort of a blossoming or a mushrooming of the array of committees through which the House has chosen to operate during this biennium. Obviously that poses challenges to, particularly counties, because there's so many programs that affect us in the wide array of committees. So it certainly makes it, from a personal or parochial perspective, difficult for us to monitor what's all going on. And consequently, more than perhaps in the past, there are situations where if we weren't careful, we could have possibly been caught unaware of legislation that may have affected us until well after the fact.
Mr. Carlson, are all of the counties in your organization meeting with the legislative delegations over the summer?
Mr. Chairman, all of the counties are or intend on meeting with, I think, again, as some of the committee knows, not only are we frustrated what happened in the tax bill with the maintenance of effort, financial mandate relief, but also since session has adjourned, committee is perhaps aware that the public defender has announced that they will no longer represent adult defendants in child protection cases. And as a result, it appears that counties are now going to be required to pick up the tab for a service that was explicitly taken over by the state during the period of 1989 through 1994. We don't have the wherewithal to pick up that tab, and it frankly is one of a litany of instances where the state, from our perspective, has reneged on its agreement with us.
Mr. Carlson, thank you. I bring it up because last week I met with one of my counties, and I requested that you be here today to present the comments on both conference committees and the end result of session, and then offer some suggestions to it. I appreciate you coming today. I would hope that if members haven't met with their counties, and they are going to, that these topics are discussed. And if they have met with their counties, then the members would go back and share with their counties the information that you presented today. So thank you for coming, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going on then, another instance of where one committee's action undermined another committee's actions. In 2006, in the Supplemental Appropriations Bill, $111 million mental health maintenance of effort, which dictates the minimum level of spending in this area, was added to the bill in relatively the last few hours. This, quite frankly, frustrated basically the long-standing intent of the tax committee to moderate property taxes, because we have no choice but to come up with those dollars through a property tax levy. Probably the most egregious and frustrating instance of one committee's actions undermining the others occurred in 2003, when there were several what we call cost shifts. Previously, state expenditures that were shifted to the counties in 2003. Examples include the cost of health care for the developmentally disabled in what are called intermediate care facilities for the mentally retarded, the same for certain mentally ill clients in what are called institutions for mental disease. And finally, a subject probably most of you are familiar with, where the state's felons who were previously housed at the state's prison systems were shifted or placed in county jails for up to 6 months of the remainder of their sentence. Again, this wasn't coordinated with the tax committee. That was the last time we had levy limits. There was no specific provision made to grant us levy authority to come up with the funds that this cost. And furthermore, the Health and Human Services shift partially undid what was a state takeover of health care cost back in 1991 when the counties traded on a dollar-for-dollar basis certain state aids for the state's cost for taking over these programs. I think consequently, given all these conflicts, we'd suggest there is obviously a need for better coordination between the Tax and Spending Committee. This does occur right now with the Tax Committee's approval of the levy authorities or expanded levy authorities in the K-12 bill. The Education Aids bill goes through the Tax Committee every year, assuming that there are levy authorities, which obviously is a frequent occurrence. But nothing similar occurs between the Tax and the Health and Human Service Finance Committees or the Public Health Finance Committees. Over $161 million, this isn't a mandate in terms of services. It's a mandate that tells us exactly what we have to spend at a minimum is spent every year and required to be raised by county taxpayers for mental health, chemical dependency treatment, child care, long-term care for under 65 individuals, the health care of the developmentally disabled in these ICF or intermediate care facilities, and increased costs for individuals who get placed in the regional treatment centers.
Mr. Carlson, there's been a discussion in this committee of establishing joint committees. The first discussion was with the Pension Commission. That the Pension Commission, which meets during session, usually twice, sometimes three times, should be established to meet on an ongoing basis throughout the interim. And then the subsequent discussion was to have more joint committees, particularly in the areas you just outlined, in the tax and fiscal areas. Do you want to respond to whether or not your group would support the establishment of joint committees between the House and Senate in the areas of taxes and finance?
Mr. Chairman, members, some mechanism to provide coordination between the two committees I think is certainly appropriate, whether that's a joint committee or requiring the tax committee review of the decisions that have property tax implications, as again does now occur with regards to the education aid bill. I don't have a particular disposition one way or another with regards to what's better, but something along those lines I think is clearly appropriate, because absent that you have these unintended consequences where one committee's actions is quite frankly undermining the actions of another committee.
Mr. Carlson, I assume that you're part of the Government Relations Council and the other lobbying groups. They have been working on a proposal to come back to us with a new committee structure. And I'm hoping, I know they're sitting out there today, that one of the things we'll see will be some recommendations for the establishment of joint committees. Representative Scalzi has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, in the area of what we're looking at for finances for this coming session, and some people say that it may be like 2003, and as you know, in state law, we have the local impact note. We've tried to make a few changes to that, which were vetoed. Do you see that helping you at all this year, or how would you be able to use this local impact note to make sure that committees are at least detailing the financial impact they'll have on local governments such as your grouping of people, and so that it's open and honest government so that people know exactly how much impact is being made?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, our organization was the entity that lobbied the original local impact note, so we clearly support it, and as you know from the discussions that I had with you and other legislators this past session where further changes were made, we certainly support the expansion. Our only reticence on the issue is whether or not the legislature and the Department of Finance have the resources to commit to this process. Right now, it is largely a local government process where we provide the information that's ultimately aggregated into these notes and provided to, prior to this last session's changes, only the tax committee chairs and the ranking members. And basically, it's been up to the legislature at that point. Because of this resource issue, our organization, which frankly has probably been the largest requester of these notes, has been quite judicious or restrained in how often we request them. But to the extent that they're adequate resources, we certainly think that those notes are an enhancement of the process and are one device to better identify what the implications are for local governments or the actions being taken by this legislature.
Representative Scalzi.
Yes, and I just think that the committee should be aware of the fact that this is in state law, and it's a good law, but if the finance department does not have enough money to effect these local impact notes, which are really the information comes from local governments with no funding to them either. But the fact that that the finance department doesn't have enough people, and we took this bill and tried to affect it this past session, but the finance department had a large fiscal note on that, so that we can't let the sun shine on some of these committee processes as they pass their funding problems down to the local governments. And that's very difficult for the property taxpayers of Minnesota.
Representative Scalzi, your point's well taken. And Mr. Carlson, when I met with my county last week, the initial reason for the meeting was a department-by-department briefing on the impact of what we did this past legislative session. And then the totality of the impact was a $1.5 million shortfall for the county. I then requested that they project out, given the possibility of a $2 billion shortfall for us in February, and the possibility of a $3 billion shortfall, given no new revenue, what that would be, given what we have now. And they should have that for me by the end of the week. And they didn't seem to have, they didn't think that was much of a real burden for them to do, that they could do that relatively easily. My suggestion to you would be to give all of your legislative delegations such information, and that they then be armed to know that if we are facing a $2 billion or a $3 billion deficit in the 09 legislative session, what it looks like department by department and then county by county, so that we have some idea of at least the totality of the impact here if there is no new revenue. And given the fact that you're hamstrung with levy limits, so that it's not likely you're going to see new revenue at the county level either. That would be a suggestion that I would offer to all of the counties in your organization.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the suggestion. I will be meeting with the county administrators from our 13 counties this I meet monthly with them, but our next meeting comes up this Friday, and I will certainly take that back to them.
Mr. Kelsey may be interested, too. I also met with Winona State ran four scenarios, given those numbers last week also, and it is equally grim at the higher ed level also. So I think we should be preparing the people of Minnesota for what is to come.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wolfsteiger has a question.
Mr. Carlson, I would like to add, I met with Wabasca County last week, and they are, as you probably know, are building a new building. And so they're running into some issues with the levy limit. So now I guess that may be unique in the state. I don't know how many other counties are trying to build a new building right now, but please look into that as well.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walschlager, it's not unique. Several counties are embarking on new buildings, frequently in the areas of criminal justice or jails, and you're correct, the levy limits have caught them. They can levy outside of levy limits for any debt service on those facilities, but there's no explicit provision for picking up the additional operating costs. So it is a problem. Mr. Chairman, going on to my next page, as I understood it, part of the focus of today's meeting was on the effects of the conference committee process, and I'll just point out a few instances where relatively last-minute actions in conference committee affected counties, which is not certainly a unique experience. This year, levy limits were not seriously discussed, and we were led to believe that counties and cities were not going to be subject to levy limits until all of a sudden during the last 2 weeks of session, suddenly they appeared on the horizon, starting with the amendment on the floor to the House tax bill. At that time, frankly, they were not too bad because they were contingent levy limits that would only go into effect if certain actions occurred. But by the conclusion of that week, the Conference Committee on the Tax Bill had passed levy limits, but still at that point, they were tolerable from a local government perspective because they included an adjustment for the full range or cost of inflation and also for household growth. Somewhat like the levy limits of recent past. But then, as I think the members know, we turned around and worked on a second tax bill to meet the demands of the governors. And finally, we were subject to levy limits that were much more draconian in effect. The inflation adjustment was restricted to about 60% of the rate of inflation with a 3.9% cap. The household growth adjustment, an important factor for particularly growing communities, was capped at only 50%. I'll have some further comments about what leads to this sort of process, but I do want to acknowledge that the chairs, particularly of that conference committee, did do a great job in keeping the association surprised about what was going on. And they did solicit changes from us that would moderate those impacts, but still we had relatively little opportunity to respond in any formal manner.
Mr. Carlson, I'd like you to articulate that for a second. And I noticed your clarification here on the chairs.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get to testify in public to the impact of that before the conference committee?
Mr. Chairman, we did not get an opportunity to testify on the last gestation, the one that was ultimately enacted, because literally that occurred within the last 2 days of the conference committee process, and there just simply wasn't any time. I think probably, again, as most of the members knew, the conference committee met well into the night, going to nearly 7 in the morning on Sunday of the last day of session. There wasn't that opportunity. In the earlier gestation, the first tax bill, we did get the opportunity to testify, but we were testifying to a much more moderate provision at that point.
Mr. Carlson, you may not wish to answer this. Would have been better had there been no tax bill at all.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer. From our perspective, yes, it would have been better without a tax bill.
Thank you.
For reasons that I will identify shortly.
All right.
Okay. In 2006, one other last-minute action that affected us was the mental health maintenance of efforts. Again, this is a provision that tells us explicitly what is the minimum amount we have to spend and what is the, as a consequence, the minimum amount of dollars that we have to raise in taxes. This was placed in the supplemental appropriations bill in relatively the last few hours of that conference committee and close to the last few hours of committee. We had no opportunity to testify on what was a major new financial mandate. Going on to what I think contributes to this process, and I don't have any ready solutions, and it's basically the timing of the administration's negotiations with the legislature or legislative leadership. Clearly part of the problem. The failure to identify the bottom line earlier contributes to the last-minute decisions that occur in conference committee, such as the levy limits that we just discussed. I'm not sure what the solution is. Obviously, time is needed for those negotiations, and the session deadline seems to dictate when and how serious those negotiations are. But until the timing of that changes, some last-minute changes in conference committees, I fear, are inevitable. The last subject I want to touch on is one that's particularly pertinent to this past session, and this is the failure to balance or at least significantly reduce the predict a deficit or structural imbalance in the out biennium will create substantial problems for local governments. I think, again, as the committee knows, well, you won't be making your decisions for the state's fiscal 2010 and 2011 until next January through May. You've already decided it for local governments for our calendar year 2009 with regards to the cities and counties, and for school year 2009-2010 by, one, appropriating the local government aides and county program aides that are being certified shortly, even though they won't get paid until July and December of 2009, and by setting the levy authorities or levy limits that are applicable for that period. The problem that the budget imbalance creates for us is that for cities and counties, the levy limits are really not explicitly levy limits. They're levy plus a levy limit. And the tax bill provided actually that there would be a $22 million increase for counties and a $42 million increase for cities. And those aides are taken into account explicitly in setting our levy limits. Basically, because of that increase, counties' levy authority is $22 million less than what otherwise the cities, or those cities subject to levy limits over 2,500 populations, levy authority is whatever their share is of that $42 million increase. The fear that is, I think, pervasive through most city and county officials is that those dollars simply won't be there, but yet our levy authorities are being set as if those dollars will actually be paid in July of 2009 and 2010. I think part of the problem is just simply the difference between our fiscal years. The counties and the cities on a calendar year basis, the states from a July through June basis. But in all frankness, establishing aid increases for a biennium where with inflation you're facing over a $2 billion deficit or structural imbalance, and then using those aids to set levy limits simply shouldn't have happened. Mr. Chairman, members, with that, I'll conclude my half testimony on behalf to answer any final questions.
Questions, members? Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, I appreciate that you, on the timing of negotiation, that you, right, not sure what the solution is. And one of the things that I think you've been present, or at least aware of some of the conversations that this committee has had before about the tension between can we actually clarify or clean all this up with different rules and different structure, or is it the personalities and the individuals living within that structure? And I think it's a balance of it, but one of the things that I think that, it takes 202 people to make law by Minnesota's constitution, regardless of whether there's a signature or a veto. It takes 202, not 201. Mm-hmm. And we do need to have greater involvement from the administration and from the governor's office, greater, I guess, collaborative involvement. But we're the lawmakers, we're the legislature, and we're supposed to have the courage to send whatever we think is the right solution to the governor, obviously with input. But I'm wondering if you could comment maybe on it's probably more philosophical, and I mean, it's pragmatic and real-world impacts of our decision to come to an agreement, a global agreement. But I wonder if you could comment on, you know, if we were to require even that there was a discussion of having the all the finance bills sent before, you know, well before sine die or constitutional adjournment deadlines, and then do policy after that, or if we were to set up a 1 month or a 2 week deadline to have all finance bills sent to the governor, for a first round, if there was a way to then say, you know, if we had to then counter a veto and decide what action to take, whether to send a second bill or some other way. I'm just kind of open-ended question, I guess.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I got to confess, I'm a rather a creature of habit. I've been associated with this process first as a staff person and for the last roughly 10 years as a lobbyist for 30 years. And quite frankly, the discussion that has occurred over the last couple years about reversing the process, doing the finance bills first and the policy later, just because of my nature, struck me as rather odd that I'm not sure how it would work. One thing that would, however, speak specifically to the issue that occurred this session, where you balance the current biennium's budget but largely left the second unaddressed, is basically you have to set the bar higher. It certainly was not the legislature's fault alone, because the budget that you received from the administration largely ignored the problem in the out biennium as well. So once that bar was lowered, I think the nature of the two institutions and their relationships is there was no consequent follow-through at the legislature to correct the administration's, what I'd frankly say was an oversight, of leaving behind, again, what's a $2 billion problem. If you can do institutional changes through your rules, you do have your budget resolutions that sort of, at least to some extent, address this issue, that certainly from my perspective would be one way to address this issue, but leaving behind a deficit of this large in the next biennium, just again, is something that should not be happening.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, I mean, I am not a fan currently, or yet, at least. I can't support flipping the, you know, doing the finance early for the same reasons, or similar reasons, I should say. But I am curious if there is some, whether it's just the courage of the legislature to stand up and say, hey, this is our budget, and to be able to present it to the people of Minnesota and not need to wait for, you know, a governor dragging his or her feet or delaying for the purpose of negotiation tactic. I mean, we have a very hard and fast constitutional deadline that we can't break, and that is the ultimate tool in the negotiation strategy. And is there some way that you can see that we could, short of the legislature just having the conviction to say this is our budget document, this is what we think should happen for the state of Minnesota moving forward, let the governor do what he or she needs to do with it, can you see a mechanism whereby we might adopt, whether they're internal rules or even a constitutional change that requires initial budget agreement or initial budget legislation sent to the governor's office well in advance of a deadline?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kalin, there are two kind of obvious solutions, but how the administration, the other party, responds, I think, is ultimately going to dictate their success. One is establishing earlier deadlines for not when the finance or appropriation bills go into committee, but literally when they have to be out and passed on the floor. If you could give yourself, obviously, a deadline that is more than 3 days before the conclusion of session, the constitutional deadline, you would certainly obviously have the opportunity to come back and do veto overrides if that's something that legislature thinks is appropriate. An alternative, obviously, is a constitutional amendment where you could explicitly have a so-called veto override session to respond to the action of the administration after the regular constitutional deadline has occurred. Again, I'm not sure how the administration would ultimately respond to either of those. Would it get them to be more serious, or would it still say, well, you're not being serious until you've done the veto override? It's not clear what effect it has, but again, those are two obvious directions to follow to improve, hopefully, the timing of this process.
Representative Todd.
The issue that was raised before, but not seriously, is the changing of the fiscal year session. And, you know, now that we've also talked about one of the things that I'm in favor of and that many people don't seem to be in favor of is the idea of a continuing appropriation so that we don't have government shut down if we don't come to an agreement by the end of session because the fiscal year ends 1 month after that. But it would seem that that would give us some of that leeway depending on how we constructed it. And I don't think that issue of the changing of the fiscal years to conform with the local units of government and how they would be, how we would budget. Obviously, our old budget would continue and the new budget would start at the same time that the local units of government fiscal year started. I wonder if that's worthy of discussion by this group or some groups and what. And I assume it's just a statutory change that we have to make. That's not a constitutional limit on the state fiscal year.
Representative, you asking for Mr. Carlson?
Anybody. I'm throwing it out to the entire group. That
might be a possibility. I want to remind members that in the discussions that we've had in this committee in the past, there have been a series of recommendations that have been put forward dealing with deadlines of all kinds. That we, one, don't really have deadlines, and that if we had them and we stuck to them, it might make a huge difference in the end product. So this goes back to a point that we have discussed before. One change isn't enough. There has to be change in a number of areas in order for any of this to work. So
but
I would remind members that we go back and start making recommendations that we have a series of them probably that we should make. In order to, and one would be your recommendation, Representative Cox.
Well, I'm not sure I'm making it as a recommendation. I think it's worthy of some discussion about what the complications from the finance executive branch and so forth, about what the complications of doing that would be.
Well,
I don't know that I was ever in favor of it in the past, so I'm starting to see some advantages and clearly, you know, as Keith reminded us again, that the fact that the local units of government and the state are out of sync is a problem. So it's another problem that it could start to, do. I'll point out, I think, some of the problems with policy finance is that it's something which I don't think has been a good idea, of the fact that we've decided that in the interest of spreading the work around every member of the legislature serves on a finance committee. When I was first elected, only a minority of the legislature served on finance committees. Very, very few freshmen ever served on finance committees. And one of the things I think that every group who has spoken before us has is that the proliferation of finance committees has been a real challenge and a real problem.
Oh, Representative Kennedy, it may have been the proliferation of both finance and policy committees simultaneously.
But it
seems to be twofold here, not just one. But
well, Mr. Chairman, one of the problems is I think the policy committees have been diminished more than they have, more than they should have been, because everyone is serving on a finance committee. And the other problem has been, and I've said this before at meetings, is that members don't carry individual bills anymore. You know, in general, most bills end up being part of an omnibus bill, and I think the worst, you know, there are good reasons for some omnibus bills, and there are, you know, obviously good reasons for omnibus finance bills, but these omnibus policy bills are an entirely new creation in the last, well, I want to say 5 years, maybe 10 years. And, you know, I think it's bad for individual members, and it's bad for the process, and it's bad for the public.
Representative Poppy, I believe, is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. I met with my county a couple of weeks ago and certainly understood their level of frustration based on a number of the things that you have prepared for us today. And I just appreciate that you gave us somewhat of a historical perspective as well, so it's not just things that happened in the last 6 months, but things that have happened maybe over 5 years or 15 years, whatever. So I appreciate that. I think it also reminds us that we have the subsequent consequences to any decisions we make, so I appreciate that. The other thing that one of the people in my county talked about was the relationship, and you mentioned this, but maybe on a different slant, the relationship that the county had been feeling with the state, that we were on a path, that we were had similar ideas and values and coming together and working more as a unit, and how that seemed to drastically change more recently, and so they were concerned about that. And I just wanted to see if you had any comments about the relationship between the state and the counties and how strained that is, and how we what we need to do to help recover just from that as well.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppe, that's clearly a very large issue for counties. I'm not sure most of the members of the committee know, but Minnesota is relatively unique in that we're one of only 9 states where the counties, not the state, administers the human service system. And for you know, the past 30 years, that system has worked relatively good because the state has met its obligation of providing the dollars to finance that system, but has, you noted, in recent years, basically beginning about 2003 or maybe the start of the fiscal problems that preceded that year, the state has stopped meeting its efforts. As I noted, in 2003, a number of what we call cost shifts, programs where we have absolutely no choice, were imposed on us. We were basically became the checkbook for the state for meeting the funding obligation that the state no longer felt it could. The same is true for the short-term offenders. Then, in addition, we've been subject to you know, the often used phrase of unfunded mandates for years and years, but in recent years we've been subject to more and more what I recall financial mandates, what are called maintenance of effort requirements in the law, where we're explicitly required to spend X amount of dollars, the $111 million that I mentioned for mental health. We're required to spend $93 million for libraries. And that's not necessarily bad, but when we compare that to the broad array of programs that we have no maintenance of effort requirement for abused or neglected children. We think that's an important issue. We have no maintenance of effort requirement for the elderly or for public safety or for transportation. We think that those should be competing on a level playing field with every other service obligation we have, and that doesn't occur right now, and that's because of this deterioration of the relationship between the state and counties that we've seen occur, particularly in the last 5 years.
Representative Potter.
I just thank you for clarifying that and making sure that we all hear that again. Appreciate that.
Mr. Carlson, I'm going to go back to page 5 of your handout, where you make a specific reference to the more stringent version of the tax bill and the 72 hours you had to respond to it. One of the items that we have discussed earlier, and I alluded to it a few minutes ago, was the idea of having stricter deadlines. For instance, conference committee deadlines that instead of 72 hours, let's say it would have been 5 days before the end of session, conference committees would have been over, that would have been it. And then the bill, there would have been time to have processed it. Can you react to having a conference committee deadline that would be hard and fast, and that there would be, I'll throw out 5 days, but not 72 hours. Let's say a series of days that both the House and Senate and those who are impacted by the bill would have time to be able to digest what's in it, and then the vote may be different when members understand they have to go home and face what some of us have faced in our counties over the last few months in trying to digest the impact. The reference here is specifically the tax bill, but you can pick almost any of them. Can you respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, I certainly would concur that some reasonable period of time between the conclusion of conference committees and the end of session to give the legislature a meaningful time as a whole, the House and the Senate, to debate those bills with more sunshine, more knowledge of the actual contents would probably improve the process. Whether 5 days is necessary or 3 days, I don't know the exact time which is appropriate, but certainly more than 24 hours, which was obviously the result of this last session where the tax bill was concluded in the conference committee at 7 in the morning, and you began processing it that afternoon with conclusion by midnight of that same day.
Members, any further questions for Mr. Carlson? Yes, go ahead, represent.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Carlson, like you, I have played a staff role as well as another role, and it seems to me, and I can't remember what was the lag, but I remember when we didn't have the computers and the laptops on the desk, and so people literally had to have printed copies of the bills delivered. There was like a 3 or 4 day printing lag. I mean, bills were teed up in terms of the education bill had to be done by this day, and the health and human services by this day, and the tax bill by this day, just for the logistics of the printing operation run by the state. And I remember in those days, you'd catch unanticipated consequences. It's sleep-deprived staff, just even in drafting errors, let alone, you know, understanding policy implications. And I know you were working then. Can you recall sort of were there problems with that teeing up of different bills with different deadlines? Because that's a different concept than just a set deadline, all must be done 5 days in advance. It was actually sort of a phase-in set of deadlines.
Galvin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, yeah, I certainly remember those days. I guess I will note that frequently those deadlines were not met, but nevertheless, staging the consideration of the various appropriations bills has ideally was intended during that time to accommodate printing schedules as much as anything else. Again, as another way of dealing with giving the two bodies enough time to consider the full details of those bills. Again, I, you know, there's always unintended consequences when you make those determinations, and obviously one of them is going to be potentially extended floor debate on each one of the 7 or 8 or 9, I forget what we're at now, for the entire budget. But you have to be prepared for that, and that certainly may well be good, but just make sure that there are offsetting consequences on the other side of the ledger.
That's been lost for you. Any other questions, members? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, Mr. Carlson, for you or for some of the members like you, Mr. Chair, who have been around under more than one or two governors, whether you could tell us, as to this last-minute issue, the issue of being surprised in the last 72 hours was something that may never have been discussed, how new a phenomenon that is. My own observation, obviously I've only been around here a short time, but just as a newspaper reader, is that past governors, including Ventura, Carlson, maybe Perpich, I don't know, has been accused of not getting engaged until very late in the Senate, or a session, and that you really didn't know where this or that governor stood until real late, and that that person just sort of hung out in the weeds. Could you or could any members who have served under more than a couple of governors just comment on whether this is a recent phenomenon? I'm talking about the last-minute surprise, independent maybe of our legislative process, just literally having something that wasn't discussed or debated until the last 22 hours of the session. Can you comment on the newness of that? Is that something you've experienced, or is that something before, or is that a pretty new phenomenon?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, I think you hit upon it in your comments that the institutional relations between the two branches has frequently over the years resulted in serious negotiations not occurring to the latter part of the session. It'd be my impression, and I don't have any factual information to back that up, that the lateness of those negotiations seem to be getting later in recent years than they have in the past. As to last-minute surprises, I just don't have the recall to say whether or not this has occurred in any greater or lesser extent in the past. Obviously, this year, with the budget problems facing the state, the demands for levy limits, this for local governments was a particularly surprising outcome that, for example, back in 2003, we had fairly stringent levy limits then, but they were well known well in advance of the conclusion of the session, and we were able to come up with the legislature with a number of things that mediated. For example, several maintenance of effort requirements were relaxed or eliminated during that period. Several other significant mandates, such as for pay equity, custody studies, were relaxed or eliminated during that period. We had nothing of that other than this provision, this controversial provision that was put in the tax bill. You know, if it had been a longer debate, I think we could have worked out better what could have at least provided some cushion for local governments in dealing with the new financial constraints that are being placed on it.
Representative Simon, there has been a migration or an elimination of conference committee itself. It's morphed into really three people in one room. The conference committees, when I first came here, tended to have more authority. You had experts in those areas that, and granted, some of them didn't finish their work until the waning hours of the legislative session. But there are examples, for instance, of Governor Perpich even going down and having to testify before a conference committee in order to get what he wants. That would be somewhat shocking today to have a governor go down and testify in order to explain to a conference committee what they want. But it would seem in the last couple of years, we've said we're not going to have conference committees per se. We're just going to have three people in the governor's office, and there may be a convenient conference committee like taxes that's still open that we can go and put information in. One of the reasons why these hearings have gone on is to analyze what's happened over the last 10 years. And I want to thank particularly Mr. Carlson for being bipartisan in his observations. Some of the problems. He's had both Republican and democratically controlled houses here that he has brought forward issues. So I'd say, in my observation, we need to go back to having a much stronger role, and this goes to Representative Tom, if she's still awake, where we had members who were sitting on those committees who understood what was going on, and when it came to the floor, usually it was the members and staff that could explain to us what had happened in these various bills, rather than having one large bill or no explanation of the public at all or testimony, and it hits the floor, and surprise, surprise, here we go. But you're always going to find the one or two instances in other sessions where there are unintended consequences, but that would be my observation. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I am interested in that. I've heard you say many times about the sort of deterioration of conference committees, or the diminishment, I guess you might say, of conference committees. And that's unfortunate. I don't know it any other way. I guess what I'm puzzling over is, even if we get our house in order in the Minnesota House, which we ought to, and I really like the three-day or five-day idea that's been tossed out today. I think that's a good idea. I'm not sure how we necessarily get rid of or overcome the last-minute phenomenon, particularly where you have a governor of one party and a legislature of another. If I were advising this governor, I'd also tell him to wait till the last minute. It's pretty rational behavior, I think, not to show your cards until the last minute, particularly when you've got two chambers of the opposite party. So I just think, in terms of adjusting our expectations, I think we can make things a little bit better, but I don't know that it'll change the behavior of this governor or any governor necessarily. I'm just trying to, and maybe there was another era when that just happened and the culture was different, but I just don't know whether, despite doing what we should do, and I hope we'll do after these hearings are done, adjust our rules, I don't know that we can really control a governor just sort of lying back, letting us do our work, and then coming out with sort of last-minute request, be he or she a Democrat, Republican, or something else.
Well, Representative, we can only do our best, and we will then have to deal with their worst, and that's all we can do. But I have no control over the governor, neither do you, but we do have some control over this body, and that's why these hearings are ongoing. Mr. Carlson's comments earlier today dealing with the evidence budget, that he also ignored the out years completely and dealt only with the short term, is a real problem for us and how we're going to respond, because their budgets have to deal with both. And they're going to have a big problem in 09-010. Big problem in 09-010. But the reason why we're here today, and this is, I think Representative Peterson had brought it forth, he wanted a more thorough discussion, an example of conference committees, and I think we're having it. And we need it. And these are real-life situations. These are no longer hypothetical. This is what's happened. So what would be our role? Representative Tom?
The worst thing I saw this year was the absence of public meetings of conference committees. I mean, that was one of the changes that happened when I was first elected. The Democrats who ran and took over the House and the Senate in 72 ran on openness of government. And there were conference committees that did not have one public meeting except to ratify a private agreement. There were some little ones and also some very big ones that did that. And I had never seen that to that extent before this year. And that's clearly not a function of the governor. That's clearly a function of the legislature. That's clearly a function of the people who were chairing those conference committees making that decision.
Representative Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I haven't served under as many governors as our chair, but I have served under three. And so I would take a little bit of agreement with Representative Fineman that, part of having this last-minute thing could be germane to the governor that we have. But on the other hand, I agree with Representative Pawlowski that it takes three to have that process, and that would be the Senate and the House and the governor. We wouldn't have to play into his hands, and we have with our leadership as well. And, I was the chair of the KCAL Finance Conference Committee. We had one meeting, and that was the timeline given us by our leadership, not the governor, but by our leadership. And we had to do some fancy footwork to, to even do that. I'm not sure that, we can't blame that on the governor. I'm not going to take responsibility for it either. I would have much rather been, given time and a target and, be able, it's not my style at all to do things that way, which is why I'm attending these meetings, so we can make some changes. And we're not making them here for the Senate. We're not making them here for the governor. We're making them here for the House of Representatives. And I just cannot be quiet and let that go on again next year. We did that to ourselves, and I'm not going to blame it on Governor Pawlenty. But when we did do that, that played right into his hands, us agreeing to the 3 weeks behind closed doors where the maintenance of effort, levy limits, and that sort of thing happened. My mother always taught me, if everybody else jumped over the bridge, would you have to do that too? No, you wouldn't. You would think for yourself. So I hope that those of us here in this room are going to think for ourselves and put up a huge fuss in our caucus if we have so many committees again. If we have the same sort of timeline where the committees have to be done really fast, the major conference committees have to be done really fast, but there's all this time for the secrecy behind closed doors, which, we cannot just blame that on Governor Pawlenty. I'm very pleased that the counties are testifying here today, and I understand from talking to other members that are here that are representative of the counties, that they're going to join us in this battle and, really go to the mat not to have this kind of process. The public needs to know what we are doing. And so I'm very, again, as I say at every meeting, pleased that we have these, and I hope our caucus leadership takes them to heart. Thank you.
President Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to respond to the, I think it was the Representative Kahn's point, but I don't want to step on Representative Greiling's really eloquent and very quietly passionate point that I think is the point here, that we need to follow our process, mm-hmm. and we need to follow the and do the right thing ourselves, and have the courage to do it. Mr. Chair, you might remember that you and I had a discussion on the House floor when I was appointed to a conference committee, I think, for a House Elections Administrative Bill that Representative Hilty carried. Private negotiations happened. It was clear what the right thing to do was with each provision in terms of the right policy move. Totally divorced from politics, I believe. And I did sign on because we had had the discussions about the bill, about the provisions, but I agreed to sign the conference committee report absent a meeting, but knowing that that might be the only time that I'd be prepared to do that. And I had the pleasure and honor of chairing a conference committee myself with what became sort of a mini omnibus energy bill, energy finance bill this year, and Mr. Marble actually was the staff member on the GOP side, and although we did a lot of work to bring Representative Magnus's provision into the bill and others and had a lot of pre-conversation, what Senator Dibble and I had agreed to be a 15 or 20 minute brief conference committee ended up being a 2 or 2.5 hour conference committee meeting, open public meeting, with input that actually improved the bill, I think, both technically and substantively. And we came back and got far more Republican support and were relatively assured of a signature by the governor. And I think it was because we actually met in the open and got feedback and were able to hear from the Department of Commerce that they were okay with the mechanism or that they wanted to have it be clarified. For me, it really highlighted the importance of having that public meeting because people caught things that we wouldn't necessarily caught. We actually improved the task force that was created and others. So I just can't say how important it is that we follow our own process. And even if it's a 15-minute conference committee meeting, that we take testimony as needed, because it will improve and it will prevent some errors along the way.
Any further questions? Mr. Carlson, thank you very much. Your document will be kept with the committee, and it's also posted electronically, so anyone who wishes to get it will be able to get it. So thank you again very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for accommodating my schedule as well.
Members, we have one more. The Minnesota Newspaper Association wishes to testify. Representative Olschweiger, do you have a question? No. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Members, Mark Anthonson. For about 25 years or so now, I have been attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association, which is the trade association of all the state's newspapers. And during that entire period of time, I have come over here and participated in the legislative process, something I regard as an honor and a privilege to do. And I've enjoyed it very much on most occasions. That tends to diminish towards the end of each session. over the course of my career, and currently, I also represent most of the other media organizations in the state, news organizations. For example, I am currently trying to convince the Minnesota Supreme Court on behalf of all of the state's news media organizations to allow what you have long embraced, which is cameras in Minnesota trial courtrooms. And they're a tough crowd. Makes me feel happy to be here instead of there. I will say at the outset that the media, I don't want ever to suggest that the media and the public are the same or have the same interests. They don't, and they're separate. And sometimes the media can be a little bit self-important about taking on to themselves the role of the public generally. But we are, because of what we sell, if nothing else, attuned to what the public wants and what the public is upset about. And so I do think we have some input on that basis. I do understand, in offering you a few suggestions and comments, something very fundamental to this process, which is you are subject to what are almost laws of the physical universe, Newtonian principles of politics. If you think how many legislative bodies there have been throughout the world, and for how many centuries they have operated, and how similarly they function, and how consistent the grievances and the complaints about their function are, it emphasizes the difficulty of what you, Chairman Pulaski, and the committee are trying to do. There is something about the legislative process that is very difficult. And the core of it, of course, is something called politics, which I respect. I don't regard that as a dirty word. You are here as advocates for deeply felt principles and constituents who are very eager to see you do what they want you to do. And your job is to prevail. And that requires, Representative Simon's comments earlier about how he might advise the governor, I think, are very apt and telling. It isn't easy, because you're always playing to win. And you should, because what you advocate for is to you and your constituents and your supporters so important. I will also say at the outset that some of the fault in these problems that have been identified lies not with you and not with the staff, but with the public itself and with the media, who have distorted, false, exaggerated expectations about what this process involves that can be improved and corrected. And I think that, as I will say in a moment, might be a fruitful source, a fruitful target for you to look at, because it's all about expectations in many respects. This is your topic of consideration, is an important issue for the state's news media. There's widespread interest in the conclusions that you will reach. We at MNA are encouraging our members to observe the conclusions that are achieved here, and more importantly, how they are implemented. And we will continue to do so. I do commend you for taking these on. Ultimately, the legislative body and the legislative process and politics itself depend on public trust and credibility. And what you are trying to do, and as I say, a very difficult task, if even partially successful, will improve your credibility, and that will help everyone in the state of Minnesota. Now, I have about 5 recommendations I'll briefly touch on. And none of these, by the way, you'll be happy to hear, I think, most of you, involve the budget or spending process, because I don't get engaged in that very often. It's one of the reasons I can enjoy my trip to the legislature each year as much as I do. My main recommendation, our main recommendation, I think, is to try and make the process easier to follow, more accessible, not in the narrow sense just of open meetings, but in the broader sense of understandability and comprehension by the public. There's a number of things that would help, I think, in this respect. First of all, something as simple as better notice requirements, better information, particularly about bills and major amendments proposed to bills. The same goes for committee agendas, trying to tighten up the process with them a little bit. The avoidance of last-minute additions to committee agendas, especially for more significant matters. I do think it would be worth attempting, and again, I'm very aware of the realities. I've been here enough to know those. But it would be great, something as simple as you could follow the committee agendas a little more tightly and tautly. Easy to say, I know. Many occasions when it can't be done. But it's one of the greatest vexations that people sitting in those committee rooms experience, especially members of the public who don't understand how it's done here. Starting something as simple, and I preach the gospel to the converted here. I know Chairman Pulaski sitting here, but starting committee meetings on time. It's a great small reminder that this is a process that really works. Number 2, simplify the bill tracking process. There's many aspects of the process right now, especially the reviser's website, that are very good. The technology is superb over here, and it has been a wonderful advance in the ability to represent constituents and clients effectively here, to have that technology. But there are some serious shortcomings still. One of which is that it can be very hard to follow a bill all the way through the process. As that bill moves along, for example, its designation will change from one body to the other, depending on action, for example, taken by the House or the Senate. And especially towards the end of the session, even experienced lobbyists have trouble locating the most current language for the most recent amendments to bills, and it drives you crazy. This can be improved. I'm not going to take your time to suggest specific fixes. I may not have the competency to tell you those. But this whole bill tracking process could be tinkered with, and the improvements would not require any rule changes. It would be simply something you'd adopt internally. Number three, I think the process would be easier for the public to follow if there were some more coordination between the House and the Senate on some of these process issues. Now again, easy for me to say, easy for us to embrace, more difficult to achieve. I'm sure it's been tried before. There are still issues. But, for example, and this has been talked about today and I won't repeat it, but the committee structures between the House and the Senate, and even in both bodies, even the names of the committees, why is it civil law in the House and judiciary in the Senate? That, I know why, but there are many members of the public I talk to regularly that are continually confused about that. It's unnecessary. Hearing schedules could be maybe coordinated a bit better. And again, the bill tracking process mechanism. Number four, I think it continues to be a great symbol of legislative engagement with the public to hold hearings away from the Capitol. It's hard to do, it takes time, you're very busy, much more coordination. But particularly on key issues of broad and obvious importance, such as taxes, education, transportation, and so forth, the fact that a legislative committee will hold a hearing away from the Capitol, whether it's outstate or in Eagan or wherever, sends a message, sends a valuable message, and may actually do more than be symbolic, because there are people, without question, who can come and attend those hearings who will not be able to come over here on the schedule generally followed. Number five, in terms of my list of concerns, and these have again been touched on a bit by Keith, but I grouped them under the title of end of the session stuff. And it's no coincidence that many of the concerns that have been expressed before this committee relate to proceedings that occur towards the end of the session. Why is that? Because that's when you try and achieve these difficult compromises on important issues. I think there is too much detail work that goes on the floors of the House and Senate now that should be in committees. Why is that a big deal in terms of public engagement? Because the public has no input whatsoever when it's on the floor. At least in committees, there's a perception that they do and that they can comment. Number two, the conference committee process, I will simply say, remains problematic. And you have identified issues that I had identified. The timing, the openness, the opportunities for input, all could be improved. Finally, in the terms of the end of the session problems, this inevitable logjam of major issues at the very end of the session. Now again, that is in part driven by legitimate political tactics and strategy, and I respect that. But it also encourages the perception in the media and among the public of the old criticism of the smoke-filled room of a small cabal of people making decisions that should be more broadly decided. How do you avoid that? I think it's very difficult, but it's a problem. So, finally, a few concluding ideas. These really aren't conclusions. I'm not going to repeat what was said, but some concluding ideas. These really aren't conclusions. I'm not going to repeat what I've said, but some concluding ideas. This goes back to one of my introductory comments. I think you can do a much better job of explaining your process to the public, and even to my clients. Expectations are so critical. I have this tan that I display in front of you, not from wasting my time on self-flagellating behavior like golf, as some of you may suspect. I hope there's nobody on the committee who's a serious golfer. But it's from coaching youth baseball, where I live in St. Paul. And one of the things I've learned doing that, because you always have 12 or 15 kids on your team and only 9 get to be on the field, you have to deal with the parental expectations or you're dead. And you have to do it at the beginning and throughout the season, and especially at the end when you get into the playoffs and then the pressure to play the best kids is better. But you can do it. It's effective. Makes all the difference. And if you would engage more effort in not controlling, I think that's the wrong word, but helping people understand the process, they would then have better appreciation for why you do what you do. And you'd save yourself a lot of grief. I think that could be done. I think in terms of considering what changes you do eventually recommend, please, and this is a gratuitous and simplistic thing for me to say, but worth saying, consider the ultimate impact of each of these changes on the public's ability to participate here, to be engaged here, and to observe you. That's, in the end, what it's all about. Because, as I said, your greatest strength is your credibility with the public. And I know you all know that. I'm not trying to in any way talk down or sound condescending. It's just useful in this kind of an opportunity to remind ourselves that that is what it's about. Final comment. Again, I commend you, Chairman Pulaski. I commend the members of the committee for taking this kind of time to talk about something that seems... This is the first time I've been over here since the last week of the session. It just seems so abstract and non-concrete, and for that reason, delicious and intriguing, that you can take the time to talk about these big picture issues because they are so important. So, thank you very much for your time. That's all I have to say.
Questions? Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson, would you care to weigh in an opinion? And I'm trying to coordinate some of the ideas that you've mentioned about the public trust in the process. One of the things that we've talked about here is that, as you've mentioned, the committees get usurped because things that are handled in committee come right back at us on the floor as amendments, and then they come back again in conference committee, and the old adage is, we'll just fix it in conference. And so those conference committees and the floor amendments just strip whatever a committee has done. And I have commented many times, why did we even spend an hour or two in committee on this? Because it just got ripped apart on the floor, and that was a vain effort. Now, that being said, if we were to tighten up the committee process so that the floor and conferences did not usurp the committees, are we not also creating the inability to make changes on the floor? I mean, you try to tighten it up and push things back into committee, and then the complaint could be raised, well, you're stripping the other legislators who are not in that committee from the ability to weigh in. How do we balance that? I mean, how do we push and empower the committees to allow the public comment without stripping this ability to comment or legislate from the floor?
Mr. Anderson.
Well, does that make sense? I mean, I'm not sure I'm answering the question right.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, it makes a good sense. And unfortunately, I wish it didn't, because then I just blather out some evasive answer and be done. I don't have a good solution to that. It's a very key part of what we're talking about in terms of my comments. We can all identify problems, but we are going to have a harder time identifying solutions. Part of it is just internal discipline in the body, among the various committee chairs and the leadership. Part of it is going to be maybe better work by the lobbyists, the advocates for these things, to engage all possible interest groups and individuals at the committee level so that it doesn't have to be backloaded. But I will be candid with you. I have more than once, and my clients have more than once, benefited from the very process you described, including this past session. And there are issues that are so important and wrongly decided by the committee that they should get another look.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not simple, but I think it can be improved, and I think in the past it has been better, and you can get back to that by better internal discipline.
Representative Peterson.
Representative Tom. One point that you brought to mind again is that one of the things that we used to do, which were just incredibly popular in among the public, and that was the session of mini sessions of the legislature at some place, where actually the whole legislature went to some place out of the Capitol. And I don't want to say that they were conducted as perfectly as possible, but I always kind of had a little, you know, why am I doing this for 3 days, particularly because I'm always on committees that don't get a lot of public attention, but was always impressed by how much the people in the area appreciated it, and how and that kind of extra attention rather than just the committee going out of state. And I don't know why we didn't reinstate them. This, you know, and I remembered only the House did it, and I remembered senators who would come to them were very appreciative in the area, were very appreciative of the fact that the House was doing that. But that's something that I would like to see. And then I guess, you know, looking at your title and who you're representing, do you think that we have anything, do you think that there's any element of blame that goes on the kind of newspaper coverage that the legislature gets and the kind of attention to issues and kind of the fact that nobody is paying attention to the fact that rules are being violated and that kind of thing? And I'll just give an example, probably a story. I don't know how many people on this committee are interested in it, but if you want to look at something on different kind of coverage and how it explains the issue, just look at the Star, and maybe there's a wonderful story in some other paper in the state, but look at the story in the Star and Tribune today on what's going on in Postville, and look at the story in the New York Times today on what's going on in Postville. See an enormous difference in a comprehension of what of all the ramifications of that story, which may not be of much interest to people, of great interest to a certain sector of people, at least in this state. And it's you know, I don't think I've ever seen you know, maybe there's some wonderful story somewhere in the state on this, but you know, but I think that newspaper coverage has totally deteriorated over, and maybe I'm just looking at a couple of newspapers, so that's the problem.
Mr. Anthony. Well, Mr. Chairman, if there's time, you could just be getting old and cynical.
Well, I'm one of the few people. I'm one of the chairman. I'm one of the few people around who actually who actually likes to pick up a newspaper and read it and get most of my information not from looking at something flashing in front of me. So I guess that's true with being old-fashioned and cynical.
Mr. Chairman, if there's time, I'm joking. I learned a long time ago that one's credibility, especially when you represent the news media, requires you to acknowledge their own failures. And I touched on that at the outset of my remarks, and I will expand briefly now. There are many failures with the news media. As news budgets, and we all understand the dynamics of the news business, very dynamic time right now. And there's not as much resources available in any news organization for legislative coverage. And there's a perception, very sad perception in many of the newsrooms, that the public isn't as interested in the details of legislative coverage. And you know what? That's unfortunate, but it is a reality. And it's a reality that I'm not a fan of lamentations as a rule. I think one identifies a problem and then rolls up your sleeves and tries, despite the difficulties and the challenges, to do your best to solve it. And in terms of possible solutions to this problem, it goes back to what I said at one point in my remarks. You can do a better job of explaining and engaging the media that are out there. It's tough. There's turnover. They often, despite, they're not going to tell you this. The average reporter will never acknowledge ignorance or lack of information, but they often have it. And they can benefit if you're patient in doing a better job of explaining the realities. Not always. They have their biases too. But that's one of the directions, I think, that still could bear fruit.
Are you
good, Pat?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Peterson, members, Representative Peterson, your comments are encouraging because I've heard a lot of discussion in our meetings about empowering committees, and that really concerned me because I believe that is where our problems come from, in the respect that empowering minority groups in the body is causing our problems. The committee is a minority group. When a committee is allowed to create an omnibus bill with amendments in committee that we would not otherwise allow on the floor, we've empowered a committee and we're entrapping the body, members of the body. So the committee has already more power than the body because we can't create omnibus bills on the floor, but we can in committee. If you look at Section 616 of Masons, number 4, it says all amendments must be germane to the subject matter, talking about a committee that has the full power with reference to proposing amendments to the measures submitted to it. So when a committee is allowed to do an omnibus bill and the body is not, the committee already has more power. So you go from one minority group back to the body, and then it goes to another minority group in conference, where, as you've just heard from the testimony from Mr. Carlson, the conference committee had the authority in this case, exercised the authority in this last session, I should say, to actually introduce new ideas that they weren't even allowed to testify on. Again, a much greater power by that minority group. And then you get to the legislative leaders where it's done behind closed doors and they have even more power. And that is where our problems are. And I really believe we need to get back to empowering the body where all the people of the faith are represented. So I found your comments very encouraging and I appreciate the discussion.
Any further questions to Mr. Anderson? No? Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Members, we have we've taken a little bit more time with this, but it was the request of the committee to take a closer look at conference committees and their impact. I want to go through a couple of things. I think Mr. Malander has one thing he wants to go over dealing with the constitutional issue. Mark. I'm sorry, Representative Olson. I'm sorry. Representative Olson had a handout. Do you want to walk us through that handout, Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're referring to the memo from Patrick McCormick?
Yes.
To myself?
Yes.
This was a memo in response to a request that I made. As you all know, I actually, for those of you who weren't here before, you probably know this anyway, but over the years I've tried to raise the issue of constitutionality of some omnibus bills that cross the line. I've stated many times that I don't believe omnibus bills are constitutional on their face, but given the process has grown or evolved to that point, I've felt that I need to accept them because it's culturally accepted in this process. But when you cross a line and have omnibus bills that involve subject area with subject area with subject area, defining them as either a single subject or subject area, but when you put multiple subject areas in an omnibus bill, to me, that clearly crosses the line of constitutionality beyond refute. And that's when I've raised serious objections historically. I've done it about 3 times, twice against my own speaker and once this year against Speaker Kelleher, with all due respect. They are not the ones that have always made the decision, but I just feel that it's a violation. As I've done that, I've tried many different bases to do it. I found many different bases to do it. I initially started in 2000 doing this by trying to do a point of under the Constitution, the single subject provision, Article 4, Section 17. When I did that, I was quite surprised to see or find out that we're not, it was ruled that I couldn't do a point of under the Constitution. And logically, I couldn't conceive of why we couldn't do a point of order under the Constitution when, in fact, we can do points of order under the rules and under Masons, which are below the Constitution in hierarchy. For example, Section 4 of Masons, number 2, says, rules of legislative procedure are derived from several sources and take precedent in the order listed below. The Constitution is the top priority. Has the highest precedent, and provisions of judicial decisions thereof, which is actually where Masons comes from, and then adopted rules, custom and usage, and statutory provisions, all of which we exercise the right, we can exercise the right to do a point of order under, but why not the Constitution when that's the authorizing provision in the first place? In accord with that, many of our rules are written to help us and aid us in complying with other provisions of the Constitution, like single subject. Now, if you look at Mason, under the section on point of order, when points of order may be raised, limitations on the use of points of order, there's three provisions under Section 242 that says it's not the presiding officer's right to rule upon the constitutionality or legal effect of a bill. That authority belongs to the House. Another provision is not within the province of the chair to decide as to the constitutionality of an amendment, and the point of order may not be raised on the ground that a bill does not conform to the subject matter as stated in the title, because this is a question that must be decided by the body. The last one that I think makes the point the strongest, Section 241. When the question relates to a violation of the Constitution or statute, such as the requirement of three readings of the bill, the question can be raised only when the measure is within the control of the body. The issue of single subject is inherent to the fact that we are not supposed to be trapped to have to make two decisions at one time, because rules of parliamentary procedure are to protect us so we make one decision. And you can't bring another decision before the body at the same time. So to rule that it can't do a point of order under the Constitution on single subject doesn't fit with logic, doesn't fit with parliamentary principle, doesn't fit with the rules, but that's become the custom and usage. And that's where I shot myself in the foot. Because by doing these points of order and making these efforts, I created custom and usage. So I've gone to another tack. And that tack is to find out if other states, this is where the memo came from, to find out if other states have in fact rules that permit the constitutional question to be asked. And we found four, thanks to the work of Mr. McCormick, who does a fine job for us. We found four. Four states who actually have a provision. The case I'm making here is that I don't believe our rules prohibit it, but since we've established custom and usage to not allow it, I think it's time we establish a rule to permit it. Because it is vitally important, and in the spirit of all the discussion we've had with the problems we've talked about, many of which of these are tied to the issue of single subject and omnibus bills. So if we have mechanisms and rules to mitigate these omnibus bills from being so big and so comprehensive in nature, it empowers the minority group. This is, I highlighted my concerns or support to Representative Peterson's comments a moment ago. This would help bring power back to the body and mitigate the over-empowering effects of the minority groups, which are the committees. So this memo is evidence that other states are doing it, and the points I just made from Mason's are to reflect that we can in fact do it with or without these, but if it helps the body to act and give some process and some clarity to the issue, I think it would be very important for us to consider a rule in the Minnesota House to allow the constitutionality of a bill to be challenged separate from any other question.
Representative Olson, thank you. And that brings us to the final step of these hearings. And that step is, there's a sheet of paper in your packet, sample format for possible community recommendations. If we could have everybody take a look at that. This was developed by Mr. Shepherd in conjunction with me as a way to address the concern that was raised in the last couple of committee hearings of how we're going to frame the recommendation. So if Mr. Shepherd would just walk through this, and then we'll open it up for discussion, because I realize we're running out of time, but that's all right. We'll have at least one more hearing. So, Mr. Shepherd?
Mr. Chair, members, the document that Chair Pawlowski referenced is just my effort to work at a sample format for your eventual recommendations. I used some substantive examples because I needed to flesh out the format, but I'm not trying to suggest the substance of those recommendations. And basically, what this does is suggest that, first of all, the recommendations might be grouped into major topics, the same ones that you've discussed for the last few meetings, such as structure and membership of committees, bill introductions, floor procedures, conference committees, and that might be an organizational format rather than kind of taking things in the order that they come in house rules or joint rules or something, but to organize it by subject. And the second main point that you'll see here is that in talking about this with Representative Pawlowski, it seems that some recommendations might be shown as exact proposed language to House rules in the strikeout and underlining format, whereas others might be more general statements of principles or concepts, because they aren't things that would necessarily be expressed in House rules, either because you don't want them to be or because they really can't be. And so the examples that I've given at the bottom of the first page and on the flip side of page two are, I just took a as a main heading, floor procedures, and just made up a couple of examples. The first one dealing with order of consideration of bills, and I tried to create an example there of something where you might actually show the exact text of the House rule that you'd be proposing to change. Same thing on the top of page two, under consideration of amendments, where you'd state your recommendation but then show the exact text of the new rule that you'd be proposing. The final one, where the subtopic is called efficiency and length of floor sessions, you'll note that recommendation one there is just stated as a concept or a principle that the majority and minority should cooperate to estimate the time needed for floor sessions and try to stick to that. And that suggestion is an example of something that would be stated just as a concept and not with specific rule language. Whereas the second recommendation under that subtopic, that the House rules be amended to forbid sessions after midnight, is just an example of a format where you'd actually propose the exact language to the House rule on that topic.
So members, I'm open to discussion. I would hope from this point forward we would actually be working on suggestions in those two venues, either specific suggestions to changing the rules, which we then incorporate in this format, or broader suggestions, principled suggestions, and these might include some of the discussions we've had with joint committees with relations with both the Senate and the Governor's office. But those, obviously, we can't control by House rules, so those would be other suggestions. So, Representative Cox.
Well, one of the things that I see kind of missing on this is reinterpretation of rules that we already have, like the ability to end debate, the ability to call the question.
Representative Cox, I think when Mr. Shepard made a recommendation about a particular observation, we can include that observation in that section, and that's a good point to bring up. That in that, we had a discussion about if we're going to call the question, that should be done from day one. It shouldn't be something that's done at the end of session. And that's an excellent point, and that would then be incorporated as a recommendation. It wouldn't specifically be a rule change, but it would be noted by the rule so that how that rule should be used. So that is an excellent point.
But the example is there's a question of using it flippantly to really cut it. I mean, we really do call the question. What happens is that the majority always does this. The majority gets up and moves to table an amendment which is then non-debatable. And, you know, I think it's much more, which essentially has the effect of calling the question. I mean, it sort of decides it. But, you know, calling the question is actually a less vicious way of doing the same thing.
Well, the problem is under our own custom and usage, we haven't used calling the question until relatively recently. And then only in one instance where it was unfortunate, it created perhaps more hard feelings than it did productive work on the House floor. So all of these two ways, I would hope, would allow us to move forward from this point. And remember, these are recommendations. Whoever's in charge here after the elections in November will take whatever these recommendations are and use them. I would hope there would be enough of the membership that would say a significant portion of these should be put into effect, and that we would then work with the Senate to the extent where we perhaps could have joint committees on fiscal or tax areas that would meet together on a regular basis. That would be another example.
And then another example, I think, which I said at the beginning and said again and gave, is a step. If people don't want joint committees, and I think the Senate has a strong opposition to that, a way of getting more cooperation and moving towards this is just joint scheduling, so that the same committees are scheduled at the same times in both House and Senate, and then you'd have the option of having some joint committee meetings, as opposed to not really having the option when our schedules are so full that there aren't any empty spaces to put in extra committee meetings.
Members, it would be my hope that you would send these suggestions to Mr. Malander, myself, and Mr. Shepherd, and perhaps Mr. McCormick. I see him sitting back there. Mr. McCormick also is a key player in this, and that we draft then a document for you to look over at the next meeting. And that document can be added to or changed in whatever format. We do have members who haven't attended the meetings that have sent us information that we would incorporate their suggestions also. But that's the suggestion, members. Representative Greiner, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wanting to have a little clarification on the process. I did send you, I think last week, my two top priorities, but I'm wondering, I haven't been taking copious notes at these meetings, and my memory isn't always the best, and now that I look at what Mr. Shepherd has done, I'm like, oh, yes, that and that and that. I'm wondering if the staff has taken better notes and could come up with a comprehensive list of some of the possibilities that we could...
Representative Garland, yes, they have.
Wonderful.
You've noticed the handwriting that's been going here, and
yes.
We've also been in discussion with Mr. McCormick and Mr. Shepherd about the plausibility of this, and they have no problem doing it this way, and that's another reason why to use this method. So,
I would appreciate if we would have a list of, not just these samples, but maybe a comprehensive list that we could rank order and get back to you that could be compiled to facilitate discussion at our last meeting.
That's possible. We could actually just do it in this format, and then you could do yay or nay or additions to whatever might have been missed to this. Now, remember, we have been doing this for a rather long period of time. Three of these hearings were done during the latter part of session after bill deadline, I will remind everyone. And then we've had actually four in the off session. So I realize that memories are strained, but we tried to keep these within at least 2 weeks so that folks did have some memory of it. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some more process questions. In terms of this committee's recommendation, will it be a straight up and down vote? Will that include those who show up physically? Can people weigh in by email in terms of literally what ends up on the recommendation?
Representative, we have had people who have given us suggestions by email or just written suggestions that they've actually sent us on what's called paper. and we've kept those and plan on using them. If you want to vote on it, we could. I would hope we would just have a consensus that these are recommendations, and we will move them forward for consideration. If you want to vote, that's up to you. But I would hope we would have a consensus. We've had a number of members who aren't members of the committee who have been here, but they are, in a sense, members of the committee now because they've been at almost all of the meetings. And we understand that these have been followed rather closely by other members on their computers, if not live, certainly video streaming, because I've gotten the emails as a result. So I would hope that we would have a consensus that we can just move recommendations forward. But if you want to vote, that's fine. Representative Peterson.
Thank you. I guess mine's a process question, too. And I would be very comfortable with taking these suggested topics. And I guess I'm, like Representative Greiling, I'd just like to see a complete laundry list of things that have been suggested by members of this committee and even those who have testified, throw it up on the board, come back to the committee, discuss each of those things, and I think as we discuss them, I learn a lot just by listening to someone else react, and then I think to myself, well, that probably is a dumb idea on my part. And then you also need to take them one at a time and go through it structurally, because you might get down to conference committees and realize that the suggestion you made for the committee makeup was probably wrong, and you might want to reverse those. Do that, eliminate it, get it down to the six or seven or four that you like, and then not even, I just suggest you then take a cooling off period, come back a week or two later and say that we still believe it. Give it a gestation period that we can think about, that we can defend, because we're going to have a long way to travel with these suggestions to get buy-in from a lot of people, and we better all believe it's worthy.
All right.
And maybe that's where you already...
That certainly can be done. That's no problem. Representative Volk, did you have a question? Representative Volk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, a process question, trying to understand. If we're going to put forth all the ideas we have, some of them are naturally going to be kind of somewhat conflicted with one another.
Contradictory.
Yeah. Contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
And I would sure think on those we'd have to vote to resolve which ones will be...
There's been some discussion of that, and we could vote, or you could list two contradictory paths, and they could decide afterwards.
And recommend contradictory paths.
Well, I don't know if they would recommend. I have a hunch that when we're all done, that whoever's in charge of this place after the election, that there will be, I would hope, a sizable group of the House saying that there have to be at least some changes. What they are, I'm not sure yet. But considering just the testimony we've taken over the last six meetings, there have to be some improvements. Let's call them improvements.
So, Mr. Chair, what we'd be really deciding is if something is in conflict significantly, we at that time take the discretion to move a vote, otherwise
sure.
Leave it?
Mm-hmm. It's fully acceptable.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Are we in agreement then that members will send us materials if they have forgotten something? We will have staff prepare, Mr. McCormick, Mr. Shepherd, and Mr. Malander will prepare a comprehensive list for us to take a look at the next meeting, and then we'll work off that list.
But also, the testimony from Mr. Carlson,
yes.
Those things are some bullet points that probably
yes.
Could be worthy to review.
Well, we also have some suggestions from NCSL that goes back to session. We have suggestions from and I would hope by this point we would have the work that's being completed by the Government Relations Council, that they could come forward with
mm-hmm.
their work on committees and others, that we could take a look at that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
all of that.
Chair.
President Simon.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Maybe to put into practice some of the stuff we're talking about here, is there a deadline before the hearing?
There is going to be one. It just has not been decided yet. My tentative deadline was to finish this by the end of August, so we would have everything done by the end of August. We have about 4 weeks here, which means we'd have time for another meeting, maybe two, and then, as Representative Peterson said, whatever recommendations move forward. So that by September, everyone is doing what they need to do to either get reelected or not.
Especially those are the primaries.
Yeah. Representative Wolfsiger.
Chair Pawlowski, members, one thing that's been in the back of my mind nagging at me on all of these recommendations is that, you know, when I think about all the committees we have, one of the reasons that the Speaker said, or I remember her saying, is that the average tenure of a legislator was 6 years, and that in creating more committees, it gave people more opportunity. And, you know, at the time, that sounded like a good thing. And I would say after 2 years of going through this, I don't like all those committees. But, I mean, at the time, it sounded good. So, you know, what I'm curious about in all these recommendations that we've been talking about is just, you know, is there any way for us to just kind of, you know, categorize them? You know, this would favor long-term members. This would favor the three leaders, you know, the Speaker, the Majority Leader, the Senate, and the Governor. And would this, you know, and then would another, is there another way of looking at it of, you know, it benefits more members?
Representative Walshager, I think in the discussion that we'll have on these, those issues will come up.
Mm-hmm.
I think you will have members who will say it benefits one or the other of those. I'm sure that will be there. By the way, if the next meetings will be open to the public, and if anyone wishes to testify on this, we would open it up to testimony, too. But you bring up, yes, those are the salient issues. And I think leadership is probably listening right now. I have a hunch.
Mr. Chair, to that point, I was thinking we were going to have a little more discussion on the constitutionality of bills, and I understand why maybe not. That's fine, time constraints. But to Representative Wolfsiger's comments now, I was going to leave one more comment on that issue, and if I may, it's very fitting to what Representative Wolfsiger just shared, and that is I've been involved in three lawsuits, one of which actually made it to the Supreme Court and prevailed, and on single subject, and the other two almost came to fruition. In the process of those other two, I learned something very significant. And that is, in most cases, to find a complainant to file, 9 times out of 10, they would say, this is really wrong, it does great harm to us, but we are afraid to come forward and sue the legislature because we'll never get anything from them again. When we can't do points of order on the constitutionality of a bill, it's very likely the case it will never be challenged. And I think we do great harm to our laws and the people of this state when we can't do those points of order and represent people on that issue by itself. Because for the people to do it, it costs tremendous amounts of money and reputation and public relations for these different groups that are affected. But when we do it, we're simply representing the people at no cost to them, relatively speaking, beyond, above and beyond what it already costs. So those who's benefiting from a rule like that? The people. And those are the issues that I believe will come out, just as Chair Pawlowski said. There's always somebody benefiting from these rules. There's always, just about always, somebody possibly being hurt by these rules. And those are very good points to consider.
Representative Scully, do you have a question?
Yeah, I'm just going back to what Mark Anthonson said was his highest comment for us, was the public's ability to engage in the process. And I think that should be sort of a mantra for us, is that we all represent the public. We don't want to leave the public out. And if we can somehow work toward that goal, increasing their ability and enhancing it to engage in the process, I think we will have done our job.
Representative Scully, I hope we have that opportunity. That's a good point. Any further discussion? Then if everyone would watch their emails for the next hearing, and then also we'll email, if you don't have the email addresses of Mr. McCormick, Mr. Shepherd, Mr. Malander, we'll get them to you. And another little format suggestion, just so you can email it, and we'll start building this for the next meeting. Any further discussion? Seeing none, the meeting is adjourned.